WHAM proudly welcomes you to Soundbite. This is America's longest-running computer show. Call the show now, 222-1180. The Choice 1 toll-free line, 1-800-295-1180. Or Star 1180, a free call for Verizon Wireless subscribers. Now, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Bray on News Radio 1180 WHAM.
Good afternoon. This is Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And Rob Linton is on the buttons. You know, Rob, we could get you a microphone. You could actually say that for yourself if you like.
Yeah.
You're part of the team here.
Yeah. He keeps us running.
And we'll be taking your calls to the aforementioned phone numbers. Give us a call, and we'll get you on the line and answer your computer questions. But before we do that, we are going to give you the news on this fairly slow news week, and we'll start with the PC world. Dave?
Oh, I get in first, huh?
You get in first.
All right. Yeah, like you said, it is a real slow news day, folks, or week, I should say. Not really much happening. But there has been a little hoopla going around this XP bandwidth. Supposedly, there is, a lot of rumor going around this QoS, as they call it, quality of service, feature built into both Windows 2000 and Windows XP. Well, there was a rumor going around that, XP steals over 20% of it. And it turns out, it's just a lot of hype, and yes, it can go up to 20% on your internet. In other words, it's out there doing packet work, and it can go up to as much as 20%, but it's not 20% and, they're up. So, at the most, it may take 5%. Just keeping things running and going smooth. So, again, nothing else to write about, so they got to, pick on something.
Yeah, right. It's yes.
It's almost a sleeper article.
Well,
the thing is,
you can look into one of the properties things, and you see that it limits bandwidth to 20%. Oh, my God, XP limits my bandwidth to 20%.
Yeah.
No, only if you're on the right server and the server.
And it's got to be running that QoS protocol. So.
Right, so that allows a systems administrator to keep the network under control, but under most cases,
it's a non-issue.
I mean, it's not going to happen.
Well, it's just like, a lot of folks, they'll run that Norton monitor and all that. Well, my system's only doing this. And what you got to realize is a lot of those utilities are written generically and, don't always hold true for all software.
Right, it's like people who call
hardware
up and say, my modem only connects at 2400, it's a 56K modem, something's wrong. Well, the connect speed is not the speed it maintains throughout the session.
It drops after 2 seconds after you connect.
Right. It changes. So.
Well, plus, most of those monitoring tools take away some of your process anyway to run
exactly
the monitor.
Right. They make it slower to begin with. That's right. So if you were marginal on getting the highest rate anyway, you would definitely show a lower rate.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, what's going on in the world of Macintosh?
Well, there's some allegations and rumors flying around the net that some of the iMac shipping delays have been caused by a firmware problem, and that's why Apple hasn't been able to ship them very fast. I'm trying to see where this was. Mac User out of UK was reporting this story I found. There hasn't been any confirmation from Apple. There's supposedly a Apple Knowledge Base article on the restricted side, which I have access to because I'm an Apple dealer, and I haven't seen anything yet.
You're right.
at Macworld Tokyo a couple weeks ago, Jobs announced that they were shipping 5,000 iMacs a day, which is just a phenomenal number if you think about it. They also announced that they've taken on a second screen vendor. The problems that Jobs said why they were shipping late is the screens are hard to build and the costs have been going up. So now by getting a second screen vendor, they can get them out even faster. So again, that 150,000 pre-order backlog is starting to filter down a little bit, but it will be a few more weeks until even at 5,000 a day before they can catch up completely.
All right. A lot of you use eBay, and a lot of you have accounts on eBay. Since January, the company's been receiving a growing number of complaints from people who say their accounts have been taken over and used to set up fraudulent auctions. The scam artists make a quick buck, then leave the legitimate eBay users to deal with the furor of bilked bidders. The company says it's only seen a relatively small number of cases, numbering in the low triple digits. That's like,
yeah,
what, 300 and
yeah.
change?
Yeah.
What
I,
happens is there
are... many million?
Yeah.
Right. The hackers are targeting people who are trusted eBay users, because you get a little sticker thing that goes on your system that says you're a trusted eBay user. And what they're doing is they're using brute force dictionary attacks against people's systems. You see, what happens is if you log on and type your password incorrectly, you get another chance. And eBay gives you an unlimited number of chances. There's no point at which it says, I'm sorry, you now have to wait an hour, and it doesn't do that. It just lets you keep on going. So what happens is, if your password is a common, is a word in the dictionary, or if it's a common word, because they also use things like, you know, Fido and you know, things like that that people would normally use.
Your pet's name, you know, your wife's name.
Your wife's name, mm-hmm. the name of a car, the name of a team.
Or birthday, which is just
birthday,
a set of numbers that allows you to crime
exactly
in.
Right. All you have to do is put all of those into a file and write a little program that tries to log on to eBay using your username and going through that dictionary. Since eBay doesn't lock it out at any point, what ends up happening is that eventually they get in and own your account. Then the first thing they do is change the password so you can't get in again, and then they own it, and they can do whatever they want, and you win. They win. So if, in fact, you... And, of course, this is general for everybody. It doesn't really matter much what you're logging into. Your password should not be a common word. But nor should it be any of those common things that people always use.
You should mix letters and numbers, and uppercase and lowercase.
Yeah.
Of course, it does make it harder for you to remember, but that's the point. It makes it harder for someone else to break.
Right. For those one or two of you who've ever gotten a disk from AOL, you've seen that the password that you use to log in is generally two words separated by some non-alphabetic character, like hello, asterisk, horseshoe. You know, so that gives you...
Hello, horseshoe.
Right. Right. So that gives you a little less chance of getting caught. So if, in fact, and you know who you are, if your password to anything is a common word or one of those common things like names of cars or baseball teams, players...
Your cat, your dog.
Birth dates, any kind of number concept. Those can be broken very, very easily these days. So you should go about changing your passwords to something that makes a little more security for the login. And that really does involve mixing upper and lower case, putting in numbers, stuff like that.
And if you're in a corporate environment, you're already used to that. You have to change your password usually every month or maybe every 2 months.
But what people...
It can't be the same password you've used before. It has to be a mix of letters, at least 4 or 5 characters.
Right. 6 is better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the more there are...
8 is even better.
Fewer the chance that someone else could think of it.
Right. I used to work with somebody who could not remember a password, so her password was A. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
And don't write it on a post-it note and stick it to your monitor.
Or under your keyboard,
because that's where we all look.
I find them all the time. Yeah.
Of course, Dave and I, being in the service field, we have to have passwords to log in to help machines. Where's your password? Lift up the keyboard. There it is.
Yeah, right. I don't even ask anymore. It's the first thing I do when I sit down to somebody's machine. I go, lift up the keyboard. Oh.
Well, I've gotten to where...
How'd you know that?
A lot of them, they don't use much imagination, so I can sit there and they... Wait a minute, how'd you get in? I put it in your password. How'd you know it? I took the first guess, and I was lucky.
Right. And then you know, I was working in a semi-corporate environment, and there was a guy who had left. I needed to do some work on his machine, and nobody left his password. And there, next to his desk, was this gigantic, huge poster for a Porsche. So I typed in, Porsche. Duh.
And if that didn't work, Porsche 911, y'all,
right,
925, or whatever it was.
944, whatever it is, right. 220, 221, whatever it takes. then there are the people who use, of course, trust no one. You know, that sort of thing. I mean, think of something a little more original. I can't use Swordfish anymore now that they've turned into... It used to be just the Marx Brothers, but now it's this. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with your phone calls on Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.
On News Radio 1180 WHAM.
I am Nick Francesco, and I'm sitting here with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Linton on the buttons, and we are taking your calls. The first caller, Bob from Penfield. Welcome, Bob. What's your question?
Well, got a problem. I cannot say...
Bob, do you have your radio up?
No, I don't.
Okay,
it's
go
just
ahead.
A bad phone.
Yeah.
Go ahead, though.
You're chapping up on the phone.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I'm on a cell phone.
Yeah.
I cannot send pictures through email. All the recipient gets are computer codes.
That's normal and intended.
Yeah.
Email is designed for sending text only. In fact, raw 7-bit text, no special characters, no formatting. In order to attach a file, that file has to get converted into text. Your email program does that for you. Your recipient's email program has to convert it back into a file. The problem is there's half a dozen different encoding formats, and your program and your recipient's program are using different ones. What you have to do is go through your email preferences, find the encoding formats your program has, UU Encode, BinHex, MIME, Base64, etc.,
right,
and pick one that your recipient has. Or what they have to do is manually decode the file, or the text, back into a file with something like the free Stuff It Expander.
What email program are you using?
I've got Outlook.
Outlook handles all of the different formats, but so apparently your recipient is using a format, has a different format than your Outlook.
Does this happen with everybody you send mail to or just one person?
I send it to myself the same thing.
Mm-hmm. The problem is also compounded by America Online, which uses its own encoding system. So if your recipient is on AOL, or you're on AOL and your recipients are on the Internet, the text encoding usually stays text. The file is still there. It just has to be decoded back into a file.
Well, I'm FrontierNet, and I send it, and then I open it myself, and it should work.
Do you have if you look through your properties on Outlook, do you have it set up so that attachments are sent as text?
I can work. I don't know. I can work on that.
Check that out. It may be that you've deliberately told it to change everything to text only. Does it come in inside the message, or is it attached as a separate file?
It's attached.
Okay, check that out and see if that's the problem.
A lot of times the attachment name will be different, MIM, HQX. It'll have a different extension, which means it's still encoded, and again, you have to manually decode it. Fortunately, the Stuff It Expander from Aladdin Systems is a free program to do all of that expanding.
Okie doke.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next caller on Soundbites is Bruce from Henrietta. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi, guys. It's good to talk to you guys again 2 days in a row.
We've missed you, yeah.
Yeah, really.
Well, Steve wasn't there yesterday, was he?
No.
Okay. Some
of us have real work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. We work.
By the way, Steve, speaking of real work, I saw a TV ad for your employer, and they had the 716 area code.
Yeah, I just noticed that. It was on just a minute ago on one of the monitors in the studio.
Oh, really?
So we're going to have them change that area code. Fortunately, the 716 area code still works until August, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I just thought I'd mention that since you mentioned employer and working.
Right.
Yeah.
I got a PC and a Mac question. The Mac question for Steve or whoever else wants to chime in is, people have been following this over the last month. I've been trying to get a Mac together for my 3-year-old, and I have a 12-inch monitor, which according to one publication was the only dud Apple monitor, and it has a low resolution, and many of the software packages I want to load require a 640 by 480 resolution.
Right, the 12-inch was 512 by 384.
Yes, and is there any extension or a init or something that fakes that out?
Not that I know of. The monitor has a physical limitation of the resolution, of the 512 by 384 resolution. The software on your computer could
memory differently.
No, it's a hardware limitation in the monitor. Some programs I've seen work on that type monitor assume a 640 by 480 and you just lose the couple inches around the outside edges. But
yes,
most of them try to switch to 640 mode, the monitor fritzes out, and in fact running an unsupported, or trying to run an unsupported resolution will physically damage a monitor.
Oh, well, I'm glad I don't attempt it once it says I need a 640 by 480.
Right, that monitor came out originally with the LC series as a very low cost model at the time, targeted for the educational market. And, excuse me, you know, 10-year-old programs probably will work in 512 mode.
Right. But the reality is, if you want to run anything else, I'm afraid you got to get a different monitor.
Well, I got to get my better one back, which I'm lending out.
That'll
work. The PC question, guys. I have Windows NT 4.0 as my OS with Service Pack 6. I have Office 97, and I'm running Word 97 Service Release 2. I recently noticed that it doesn't keep the list of most recently worked upon or saved documents in the file menu, even though I've gone repeatedly to the tools to tell it, please keep the last 9 documents in the list. It only keeps 1 if I launch the document and not the application, Word. If I launch the application or the document, Word will launch, it's associated with Word, and it'll be the one and only file in the file list at the very bottom of the pull-down menu.
Right. When you installed Word, did you install it as the administrator?
Yes. And I use it as the administrator.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've seen this happen depending on whether you change the file, whether you save the file. It doesn't count it recent until it meets certain criteria. Just opening it may not consider being recent.
But right. It's history list, though. It's not keeping, you know, if I'm understanding you correctly, if you open, say, 6 documents, only the last one actually shows up.
When I go back into Word again.
Yeah.
That could be a corrupt registry entry where it remembers.
That is a registry entry.
Yeah, where it remembers how many. Try setting it down to 1, rebooting, setting it back to whatever you want.
Yeah. It is a registry problem. That's why I was wondering if you were not in as the administrator or hadn't installed it as the administrator.
Okay.
It's saved in the registry, so you may either have a corrupted registry or, as Steve said, it just missed it, and now if you set it to 1... reboot, set it up, it might work.
I'll give that a shot, guys.
Sorry.
Thanks for your advice.
Thanks. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Linton on the buttons, and me, Nick Francesco, on Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. It's true. We're back. I'm Nick Francesco with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Linton on the buttons, and Carl from Pittsford on the line. Welcome, Carl.
Hi, guys. Thanks a lot, and thanks for all the help and advice over the years.
Our pleasure.
I've got 2 quick ones, I hope. Running Windows 98 Second Edition. I've got 2 hard drives, C and D, 2 CD-ROMs, E and F, one of which is a burner. And all of a sudden, I've got this Phantom G drive labeled removable disk. Is that a problem, and how do I get rid of it?
Did you ever or used to have a zip drive?
Zip drive, yeah.
Nope, never had anything other than what I just described.
Well, it apparently thinks you did.
Are you running, what are you running for burning software?
The Roxio that came with the burner.
Is it a burner, or is it both a burner and...
Reburn.
A reburner. A writable and a rewritable.
Yes, it's both.
Oh, yeah. The other thought I had is, are you running McAfee?
I was, and I switched over to
McAfee
now.
Used to create a volume called Safe and Sound. And what it did was create another volume letter that would be like the G. And if you had Safe and Sound on there, it would create another drive letter. It was a backup of the image of your system.
Okay.
So it's try eliminating or deleting it. Make sure that you fully uninstalled McAfee.
Or at least Safe and Sound.
Get rid of that Safe and Sound. Make sure that's not being loaded in the, if you go to MS Config in the startup group, make sure Safe and Sound isn't being loaded, because that will create another volume letter, and it's more or less a backup of all your stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I think I did uninstall everything.
The other thing to check is to see if the Roxio, check the Roxio documentation, see if it didn't create a separate drive, Phantom drive, one for writable CDs and the other for rewritable CDs.
Okay. When I click on this GM properties, there's nothing there. It's zero everything.
Right. It might be that you don't have a rewritable CD in the drive at that moment.
Oh, okay.
And even if you did, of course, it would still be, well, you'd now theoretically at least see 640 meg available.
Something.
Yeah. But it doesn't hurt to leave it there, then.
No, but try. But see, you know, if you find out what it is, that might be a good thing too.
Right, right. Okay. The other question: when I go to my C drive, the root directory, at the very top of the list, I've got a couple of these files: _istmp.sumnumber.dir. I open up each one, and each one appears to contain two DLLs and a file called core comp.
They're temp files that an installer has created when you installed something and then didn't delete when it finished installing.
Right.
Okay, so no problem in taking them out then.
Yeah, it may
have the uninstall program in it for whatever that program was.
But the other thing, too, is what I always recommend to folks is create a directory called temp or whatever. Temporarily move them over there, run your system for a few days, making sure that, you know, in running various programs, that they're not tied to something else. If no problems, then you can move them to the trash and get rid of them.
Okay. Well, I've got the whole C backed up to the D using Ghost, so
there you go.
It does the same thing. And I've got the same sort of directories under the Windows folder. Same idea.
You might want to go into your, where's it set? The AutoExec, and set your temp variable, T-E-M-P, to equal like C:temp, and the T-M-P variable. And what that's supposed to do is that when a program wants to create temp files, it puts it in the directory you've told it to instead of wherever it felt like.
It might be
at the root, it might be at Windows, it might be at Windows System.
Is it? What is the file name? I-N-S-T what?
No, it's _ISTMP, and then a number, and then .dir.
Yeah, install temp.
Right.
Right.
And, of course, they're at the top of the list with that underscore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's general. A lot of machines do that. Almost all of them, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Novell does it. If you were doing Novell, you'd get one. But almost everything you install puts one in there. Usually, it gets directed, or rather deleted. I mean, when after the install.
Good programmers should do that.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, guys. And one last word: Think Archives.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thanks. Appreciate that. Yep. We are thinking them at every moment. Of course, we're not doing anything about it, but we're thinking them. Our next caller is Steve from Rochester. Welcome, Steve. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Appreciate it a lot. This is a question, I think, for Steve.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new iMac, a G4 with a flat panel, and our previous computer was an old Mac clone. It was a Power Computing PowerCenter 150. And right now there's quite a lot of image files, some fairly large files. We want to transfer from one to the other. I'm wondering, which is the best way to do this?
Ethernet. Set up a network between the two machines and turn on file sharing.
Okay.
And that way you can actually mount the one computer on the other one as a remote volume and drag the files back and forth.
Okay. Simple enough.
Yep.
That sounds great. Thanks very much.
It's really slick with a lot of the newer computers that have FireWire built into them, because one of the features of the FireWire is what they call target mode, that you can actually plug the two computers together with a FireWire cable, and it shows up as a direct hard drive rather than a network volume.
Okay.
So that's kind of neat when you get into new enough machines that have FireWire.
Okay.
Okey-doke.
It'll work pretty good.
Yep.
Sounds like it.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Linton, and me, Nick Francesco, on the known universe's longest-running computer call-in show, Sound Bites, on 1180 WHAM.
On News Radio 1180 WHAM.
Actually, wouldn't the old-fashioned way involve beating on hollow tree logs or
sending up smoke signals?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Okay, we're back, and we're going to take your calls. Moving on now to Alex from Fairport, New York. Welcome, Alex. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Got a problem in the last maybe 2 weeks with trying to get onto the Internet. A little screen pops up when I hit Explorer that says Content Advisor. And then when I go on, that does... go to my supposed homepage at Roadrunner. I get this message. It says that the action's been canceled, and it has a little eye on the page. And then when I do go to, like, Tools and scroll down to Internet Options, and I click on Content, I have to go to Settings and Disable, and, you know, Disable Content Advisor each time I go on the Internet.
It doesn't remember that you've disabled it?
Yeah.
Tell you what, I've got actually a fix for you.
Well, there's actually two different issues there. There's one where the content advisor, for those of you that aren't aware, is a way to set Internet Explorer to only go to certain rated sites using like the movie ratings. The problem is not every site is rated, so you can set the content advisor to not let you go to unrated sites. So, you know, like ABC.com might be unrated and you can't get to it.
Hey.
There was an early problem where the content advisor would get turned on by a corrupt registry entry and you couldn't turn it off. But in your case, you can turn it off, but it's not remembering that.
What, if you want, email me. Go to our Soundbites webpage.
Okay.
And I'm on there. I will email you a file that will totally clear, it literally clears all the history and everything else that you had in that file.
Yep.
And you can start fresh.
And this is Nick or is this Steve?
This is Dave.
Dave, sorry, Dave.
No problem.
Well, you tried two out of three and missed it. I wouldn't go into skydiving as a
It involves
hobby.
Mucking about in the registry pretty deeply, which is why Dave has his program that does it instead of letting you do it and accidentally deleting something else.
Yeah, it's so much easier when you're on our news. I can just, like, see you on TV while I'm talking to you.
That's exactly right. But that's Dave, and you can email Dave.
Dave is the one without a beard.
.org.
Yeah, I'm the only one without the beard. But
okay.
Right.
All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Sure, thanks. Our next caller, Chuck. From East Rochester. Welcome, Chuck.
Gentlemen, that's a good...
Who walked in?
Hello?
Yeah. No, you said gentlemen. We were just wondering who you were talking to.
You, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I've had the pleasure of speaking to you before. In fact, I believe I asked Dick if he knew where I could find a copy of Blasey Engineering's PC Master.
Yeah?
I have an old dinosaur here, an old Wang, which I assume is no longer produced.
Not by anything.
Anyway, I have WP5 installed on the hard drive. And let us say I put a disk in drive B and call up a specific file.
Right.
From that disk.
Right.
Now, I do what is normally... what is the normal procedure? And yet, I often get back a message which says, through the speech box mode on the type and speak, it says, error, incorrect drive path specification. I wonder if you could clear me up on that, please.
Off the top of my head, no. Do me a favor. Email me, nick@asknick.com. I will look into that and get you an answer. But we have to go, I'm afraid, because it's time to cut into the national news. This is Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. And if you've got a little tingle in the pit of your stomach, it's probably because you've skipped lunch, because you're just listening to Soundbites.
And he always screws up my name. I don't know
what to do.
He's got a hiccup right in the middle of my name.
He's got gas and hiccups.
And before your name that he screws up in. Like he said, I'm Nick Francesco with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Linton on the buttons. We're talking to Jim from Rochester, New York. Like we'd be anywhere else. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
Yeah, I was curious about super discs. Do you know anything about them?
Sure.
They never caught on like everyone was hoping.
I use them fairly regularly. Some new mother, particularly if you get one of the motherboards that deals only as a server motherboard, it won't take them. But most motherboards nowadays will. It depends on the BIOS. Basically, they look like a floppy, but they hold 120 megabits of data. Megabytes of data. The problem with them is they're only floppy speed. And trust me, if you think floppies are slow, try writing 100 megabytes to a floppy disk. It's going to take you hours.
Didn't they just come out with a new 240 meg model?
Yeah, but it's still slow.
Zip is a better way to go.
Now CDRWs have eclipsed all of them because of the capacity and price.
Yeah. Right. But the nice thing about the super discs is that the form factor means that you can get them in places where you can't get other things, super small systems and stuff like that. But they do work, and they're very nice products. The discs you need to be a little careful of, as with any medium. You need to be a little more careful with these than you do with floppies because they hold so much more. When you damage them, you lose a lot more. But in general, they're very nice products.
Although their website isn't working at the moment.
They are slow.
Oops.
When you say it's slow to download to them?
Yes.
Copying a file to it or copying a file from it is at floppy speed. So and floppies are relatively slow compared to a hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives you the greater capacity. So they were hoping it would actually replace the floppy drive and start shipping in a lot of machines.
And that's where zip disks, though, wound up catching on bigger. Are better, rather, because they did a better job of it, and you can, you know...
And they're faster.
Yeah, because they're going over an IDE cable, and you can put them in a 3.5-inch floppy slot.
And then there are the new super disks, the new orb drives.
Yep.
2 gigabytes.
They have a 5-gig model.
They don't seem to work very well on XP, but other than that, they work pretty nicely. But there's the scoop on super disks.
All right, thanks a lot.
Sure, our pleasure. Our next caller, Steve from Rochester. Welcome, Steve. What's your question?
Hello?
Hi, Steve. What's your question?
Oh, I'm so glad to be talking to the three greatest minds in the computer industry.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you seem to have called Soundbite.
Yeah.
What's your question?
Boy, did they misdirect you.
Wow.
No, they didn't. I have been struggling with this problem, going back and forth to news groups, and nobody's been able to help me. I put a new motherboard on, an Intel motherboard, and put 512 DDR RAM in it. Reloaded ME. Now, I know your opinion on ME.
No, go ahead.
But every time I try to play something on Windows Media Player, Winamp, I even put Ultra Player in, it always plays at 2x speed. I've gone in and changed the digital mode to enable it, disable it. It doesn't matter if the source is a CD or the hard drive.
Did you check for any drivers for your CD?
Yes, I have.
Is your sound card built into the motherboard or separate card?
Built into the motherboard.
Did you check for any updates to that?
Yeah. Yes. Is
it just sound or is it also video?
Also video. Now, the only time it doesn't, if I were to put a music CD in my CD player and push the play button on the CD player...
Mm-hmm.
That works fine. Then it comes out at a normal speed. But if I play that same CD through any of those other three media, it doesn't. It's 2x. Everything is 2x.
Well, yeah, and that actually makes sense because when you play a CD, it's actually playing it off of the CD drive using the CD drivers. When you play everything else, it uses the internal drivers and plays to the sound card. This is clearly a driver issue. It sounds like a sound card driver issue.
There is a little slide bar in Windows Media Player to control the playback speed. Have you tried playing with that?
No, not the speed.
You might want to give that a shot.
Yeah, it's...
But it doesn't matter which one I'm playing it back with. I mean, I like Media Player, and it's 2X, so I went to Winamp, and then that was 2X, so I even tried Ultra Player. And that, everything is 2X.
Yeah, that does sound more like a driver problem.
Yep.
Yeah. Your computer's too fast.
And that's it.
Put a slower processor in.
I go to the 900 instead of the 1.8.
Well, one thing that you might want to... What was the processor speed again?
1.8.
You might want to look into going for the upgrade for Windows XP. I mean, you've got the horsepower there.
Well, my thing on XP is that every time I've bought a system, I've always had to go out and buy the second edition. So
yes, and there never will be one for ME, I think.
Pardon?
Here's the other question I have.
ME won't be updated anymore.
No, I know, but I'm just waiting for the XP second edition.
Right, you have a 1.8 gigahertz processor.
Correct.
What does it report itself as being to the system?
That I don't know. How would I find that out?
Well, there are two ways. One is when it boots up.
Okay.
And that will probably report 1.8. And then the next question is, if you right-click on my computer and select Properties... Oh, no, you're using 98, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
No, he's using ME, and it doesn't always tell the processor speed.
It doesn't tell you the processor speed.
It'll tell you that it's a Pentium whatever, but it doesn't actually report... the gigahertz.
See, what I'm wondering is if something isn't incorrectly reporting the processor speed, and therefore it tries, because now we're talking about timing issues in playing things, which you're not talking about off the CD because that's controlled by the CD hardware.
Okay.
So it sounds like there's a timing issue and that it thinks it has to play it twice as fast as it needs to in order to get it to work.
The best place is, like you said, upon boot up, you can hit the pause screen when you get that rectangular box that goes all along the top of the screen. Hit the pause key for a second, and it will tell you over in the upper left-hand corner what it thinks it is. If it, you know, it's not reporting the correct processor speed at 1.8, then you can always go into the BIOS, and it's the second option down that you can adjust the processor
speed. And a lot of times, the motherboard in BIOS assumes the slowest processor until you tell it otherwise. So if your BIOS thinks it's a 900, then everything would be running too fast mm-hmm. because it's really 1.8.
So the only problem with this Intel chip with this board, it doesn't give me that screen you're talking about. I know when you're talking about, because I used to have it before.
Mm-hmm.
Now it just gives me the blue Intel.
It's behind that.
Yeah, I know.
There's if most of the Intels are F2 to get into BIOS, and you
right.
can turn off that startup screen. So you can get back to the BIOS information screen. I also found a really neat website called annoyances.org.
It's a great site. It really is.
For people to post their annoyances. And this is apparently a very common problem. And most of the responses are saying that it was a driver problem.
Okay. Should I go to this annoyances.org? Would it give me any more info? Or?
Well, it might, but the reality is it sounds like a driver problem. Have you been to the Intel website and downloaded, seen if there are extra drivers, newer drivers?
Well, 2 weeks ago when I put it in, I did all of that. I'm presuming that 2 weeks is probably...
Yeah, but see,
and
you never know.
Did you make sure you got drivers for ME? The other thing is that motherboard rated as compatible with ME? It may be that it loaded Windows 98 driver, which will not work correctly.
Well, you know, if you can put up with this just for a little bit longer, this quarter, XP 2nd Edition is due out. So you're only talking maybe another month or so if you can bear with it. And then just upgrade your system to Windows XP.
Which is certainly a possibility.
Yes. But well, it supports multimedia better and all the memory that you've got in your system.
Right.
Okay?
Okay. Thanks. You see, I told you it was the three greatest minds in the computer world.
Right. We're telling you we don't know the answer either, but it's probably a driver problem. Okay.
And I didn't even go wild on ME.
That's exactly right. We are going to take another break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Litton on the buttons, and me, Nick Francesco, on Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Yes, indeed. I am Nick Francesco, sitting here with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Rob Litton on the buttons. Before we get back to the phones, we want to talk about the poll. We have a website called soundbites.org, and you can get there through wham1180.com. Go to the main page. Down on the lower left are some buttons. You'll see our smiling faces. That will take you to soundbites.org. There, you can vote in our poll. Last week's poll was, I use email at work to send private messages. 187 of you voted in the poll. Thank you very much.
But how many from work?
Exactly. We don't know exactly, right?
Probably most of them.
And the winner, by a wide margin, was regularly without giving it a second thought. That was 43% of you. 23% of you said a few times a week. 17% of you said once or twice, but it was an emergency. And another 17% of you said, why? What else is it for? This week's poll, and please, for God's sake, if you have a poll idea, please send it to
me. We're begging for it.
I'm so out of ideas at this point. I have a camera attached to my PC. It's a simple yes-no choice. It shouldn't take you long to vote in the poll at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y. There are 60 votes in the poll so far, and no is winning about 2-1.
Should I assume you meant like a webcam?
No, it just says I have a camera.
Because I occasionally plug my DV cam in and edit video.
There you are, then.
But it's not a yes or no. It's occasionally.
It's a Mac guy.
There's never enough choices.
And therefore, those of you who don't like the poll can join the forums. We have a group of forums where if you want to ask a question, we have an able bunch of volunteers who are answering people's questions left and right. One of those forums is called Why This Week's Poll Stinks on Ice. And you also can register your displeasure at the fact that I screwed up yet another poll, and that's why I need you to send me some.
We need the Mac guy here to get off his butt, then.
That's right. Give us some poll ideas.
He doesn't like it. Come up with more ideas.
So please vote in the poll at soundbites.org. 66 of you now. And we'll
we also want to
update that next week.
We also want to encourage folks to register on our site. We don't, you know,
in the forums.
Into the forums. Go in there and please sign up and put in where you're from, your city and state. Of course, if you're from Rochester, we still want to know that. We don't, pass out your information or anything like that. We're a bunch of geeks, and we like to just see where we're reaching out to.
Yeah.
I mean, we just got somebody from the Virgin Islands.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. I mean, that is
cool.
St.
Thomas in the Virgin Islands. A pretty neat idea.
It's just stuff like that we like to track.
And we're taking your call. Oh, sorry, Steve.
Well, actually, what I was going to mention is this week, Apple UK created a really slick web page, Mac and PCs, a guide to peaceful coexistence.
Nice.
It's been possible for years for Macs and PCs to share data files, to share networks, to share internet connections, etc. But Apple has put out this really nice 35-page pamphlet on how to do it, what to do it with, and the different solutions available.
And that'll be up on our website, Mac and PC Coexistence.
Yep.
From the UK. And speaking of the UK, by the way, today is National Cleavage Day in England. I think that's important to note. We're going to go back to the phones now.
Are they going
to
wear their black armbands, too? Because
why?
The Queen Mother died.
That's right.
Oh,
so it's going to be, the answer to that is exactly right. Kind of puts a damper on.
So you have to wear your little black dress with the extra cleavage.
Okay. We're going to go back to the phones now and talk to Jim from Geneseo. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Great show.
Thanks.
Great show. Hey, listen, I'm working with a compact Presterio, and it's got the Microsoft XP Home Edition.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is America Online, I go into Start, and you go up to Settings and Network Connections. It says disconnected. And I don't know what happened. How do you get it back so it's enabled?
What version of AOL are you using?
7.0.
I believe I remember reading problems about AOL 7 and XP.
Figures.
I was still thinking about the red dresses and black armbands.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you download the AOL 7, or did you use it from a CD
to install 7? This has been working right along. And all of a sudden it just disconnected, so...
If you go into the network connections, now I got to do this, trying to do this mentally here. So you got to go to Start, Control Panel. I think it's the. Oh, I haven't done this enough, but you've got to get to where you can get to the network properties, and in there you can sit there enable and disable.
On network properties, right?
Yeah, it's in the network properties. You'll
see hidden it in XP, though.
Yeah, just when you learn to get one thing, you know, one place to move it on you. But you'll see it, and it'll say the properties are the, for your protocols and all that type of stuff. You can right-click on that little icon that'll be in there, and one of the options is to enable it. But you're going to have to do a little searching. Like I say, you just learn where things are in one operating system, and then they move it around in another.
Also, don't forget that did you install AOL off a CD?
No.
Off of a download.
Download, that might help.
Have you run any of the XP updates recently? Because that it might have broken something in AOL. Where I was leaning is that you might want to go back to AOL and try to download another copy, because they often update their version numbers, their minor revision numbers, without changing the major
number. Should mention that. I just had a client.
Yeah, this is PCTEL Plantum V.90 modem.
Does it work otherwise?
What do you mean?
If you try logging in somewhere without AOL...
Okay, what happens is when I log into AOL, it goes up to the part where you checks the password.
Yeah.
It says goodbye, kicks you out. So, I mean, well, it's just disconnected.
Do you have any other programs that use the modem?
No.
Well, what that sounds like is, you mean you put in your password and then it kicks you out?
Right. It says goodbye, kicks you out.
It should ask you for a new password. Or if you've typed your password wrong, it should give you a chance to type it in again. And if it's wrong too many times,
might want to call.
Please check again when you can remember your password.
You might want to call the folks at AOL and find out if you've somehow gotten locked out for some reason.
Okay.
Because it sounds like that's what's happened, rather than there being a problem with the system. If you can actually dial and get to the point where it asks for your password, assuming that you don't have caps lock on or something like that, then it sounds like the problem is at their end. They may have locked you out for some reason. Mm-hmm. I'm sure incorrectly, but you need to find that out from them.
Okay. All right, sounds good.
Okie doke.
All right, thank you, sir.
Remember
thank
the olden days
much.
When you used to be able to just dial another BBS to make sure your system worked?
Exactly right, not anymore. We're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave, Steve, Rob, and me, Nick, on Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Actually, we'd rather do our show in a hot tub. But I don't know that I want to be in a hot tub with these people. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
Rob Linton's on the buttons with no microphone, and we're talking to Jim from around the corner.
He's shy.
He's a shy guy. What's your question, Jim?
Hi, guys. I got a file sharing question for Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I want to say you guys did a great job on Lonsbury yesterday.
Thank you. We had fun.
We had fun.
It was fun. I got two iMacs. I just got a new flat screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a old Bondi Blue 233. And they're both hooked up to a 10-100 Ethernet hub.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm running 9.1 on the old one and 10 on the new one. But they don't see each other. I turn file sharing on, and they don't. I was going to zap my files from the old one to the new one, but they don't seem to see each other.
There's a couple of tricks involved. One is that under OS X, Apple Talk is turned off by default, so
uh-huh.
it's using TCP. So on your OS 9 machine, when you go to the chooser and the Apple Share file server client, the browser only works on Apple Share. You click on the IP address button and type in the IP address of the other machine and log in via TCP.
Oh, okay.
Or on the OS 10 machine, go into your network preferences and turn on Apple Talk, and then it shows up in the browser.
But if this is the only thing you're going to use Apple Talk for, there's no point in crowding your network with an extra protocol that never gets used.
Right. IP is more efficient than Apple Talk.
Uh-huh.
The same thing works the other way, that if you're in OS 10 and you go to connect to server, it only shows the IP servers.
Mm-hmm.
The network browsing is a really tricky issue, even under the Windows networking, to get all of your servers listed in the browser. So being able to type in the direct IP address of each machine gets you straight to it a lot quicker.
Okay.
And under OS 9, to turn on IP file sharing, you go to your file sharing control panel. By default, OS 9 uses Apple Talk and OS 10 uses IP, so you just have to get them both talking the same languages.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okie doke.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim. Our next caller is Andy from Rochester. Welcome, Andy. What's your question?
Yeah, hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Okay. I got a simple one for you. I got a computer here. Basically, the kids play games on it.
Yeah.
And we downloaded a game and had a problem with it. I guess it wasn't enough memory. So I went and had some chips put in it. And I went from, first of all, I only got an 8 mega RAM hard drive. You there?
Yeah.
Okay. And then we went from 16 to 48 on the with the chips for speed or memory or something like that.
Memory.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what the guy told me was that without going into another hard drive, which is kind of expensive for that, that for a price, he could clean up the hard drive, which would probably get all the erroneous information out of there that the kids put in there and stuff like that.
Right.
Now, I guess it's pretty much my only option to do something with that computer. From what I understand, Norton SystemWorks has something I can use for about half the price. But then I was told by somebody else that won't work because it's only 8 meg.
An 8 meg hard drive?
Yeah.
No, you might have 8 meg free.
Yeah. But it's got to be at least, you know...
It might be an 8 gig hard drive.
Yeah.
Right, or it could be an 800 meg hard drive. I mean, the amount you have free tells us nothing about how big the hard drive itself is.
And if you had 16 megs of RAM to begin with, the machine is probably really old and might have an 80 meg hard drive.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but right. 8 meg is probably what you have free.
The best
okay.
way.
Well, when I walked out of the place, there was no question in my mind. What the guy told me was that you got a small hard drive. It's only 8 meg. So, but maybe I'm mistaken.
Maybe he meant.
Well, the easiest way to find
80 meg, 80 meg.
Right. The easiest way to find out is if you click on my computer, and then right click on the C drive. It'll tell you the size of the hard drive.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. It'll tell you both the size of the drive itself and how much free space you have left.
All right. Now, if a guy wanted to clean up the erroneous information in there, short of paying somebody to do it, is there something available that will work on mine that a guy could do it myself? You know, I could do it myself?
There is a utility inside of Windows itself that will clean up some of it. If you open My Computer, right-click on the C drive, choose Properties.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tabs is Tools.
Right.
One of the options under that is Disk Cleanup. And that will clean up a lot of your internet temp files, your Windows temp files, and things like that.
This thing's never seen the internet, so, okay.
Okay. You can also go to the Add Remove Control Panel and remove programs you're not using anymore.
Yeah, we did that to get another game done right.
Right. So that's pretty much all that can be done. An 80-meg drive is only going to hold a certain amount of data, and at that point, you're kind of done.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But by cleaning up the temp files, by cleaning up the temp files and deleting games and programs you really don't use so much anymore.
Right.
There's probably a lot of installer temp files left around.
Right. And the disk cleanup will get rid of a lot of that stuff. So give that a try before you spend any additional money. But beyond that, you're really going to have to make a decision as to what you can delete to make room for new stuff.
Is this a system where, obviously, this won't delete the operating system, and then I got to download 95 again, right?
Right.
Well, if you could accidentally delete the system yourself if you delete the wrong things.
Right. But if you follow the steps we've given you using the Disk Cleanup tool and the Add Remove Programs tool, and don't add or remove Windows components, which is one of the choices.
Right.
You're
fine.
Don't
do that.
You're fine.
Can you repeat real quick again the other one besides Add and Remove?
No. Sorry, it's the Disk Cleanup tool. If you double-click on My Computer,
right-click
on a drive and select Properties,
right. You'll
see some choices, one of which is the Disk Cleanup tool.
I got it. I know how to get there now.
There you go.
Thanks, fellas.
Our pleasure. Our next caller is Chris from Shiloh. Welcome, Chris. What's your question?
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I got a question about the Content Advisor.
Yeah.
I was messing around with it.
Uh-huh.
And I got in there, and I went and looked to see what the settings were, and it said if you don't want your kids to get in here and change things, to enter your password.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now you've forgotten the password.
No, I did that, but apparently I had the caps lock on, so I couldn't get back into it. So I called... I called Roadrunner back, and this one guy talked me through it, and he says, well, it might be a problem with the program. Let's see what we can do. And he had me delete.
I hate to hear that word.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, he had me delete ratings.pol out of the Windows file. Now that's completely gone, and nothing works.
Yeah.
You cannot access any websites at all.
Yep.
You have to go back to the Content Advisor, enter the password you originally did, and turn it off.
It doesn't seem to work.
Then you must
tell
have
you
entered
what,
the password wrong.
You're in some trouble, because that PL... Did you empty the trash?
He told me to get rid of it out of recycle bin.
Email me.
Dave Enright, dave@soundbites.org.
Okay, email me, and I will send you a file. You put it into a temporary directory, and it will clear all the information that you've put in the Content Advisor.
Okay.
And hopefully it'll rebuild that policy file, because if it doesn't, he's still doomed.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they also said that I might have to, call Microsoft, and you have to...
Well, that's where you should have started, because it was a Microsoft program.
Yeah. Email me, and I'll send that to you.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Sound Bites on 1180 WHAM. That's right. Call the boy. Sweet me. I am Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And there's Rob Linton. Still, he's got a microphone sitting over there. He won't even bring it over.
He won't even use it.
Well, he's got another one on the other side of him,
too.
Remember, we could have a mysterious.
That's right. We're going to talk to Dave.
We're going to get him. That's got to be one of our goals, finally get him to chime in.
Get Rob to actually say something in the air.
So folks know that there's actually a live person handling the board.
That's right, as opposed to, the Rob bot. Our next caller is Dave from Lima. Welcome, Dave. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Good show.
Thanks.
I got a question. Some time ago, a month ago, I opened up something from a floppy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, everything I do, I can hear the computer addressing the floppy drive going click, 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 and before it'll open anything. Even though I'm not, saying open with a floppy, it's searching that floppy drive, and it's kind of like, why is it doing that?
And it's remembering that you did open from a floppy and building your recent list to have that file in it.
Yeah, what did you open this in, Word or Excel or PowerPoint?
No, it was in AutoCAD.
Same idea.
Yeah.
They all have a recent files list.
Right.
And one thing it does is look to see that it can access all those recent files.
Right. But, I mean, what I'm saying is that no matter what even if I'm just opening up a folder, it goes to the floppy drive and clicks on it.
Well, because Windows itself has a recent list
right.
in the start menu.
Well, how do I get rid of it?
Is
that something I can live
right
with?
Click on the taskbar,
yep.
bring up properties, and one of the options is the clear documents folder.
Clear documents.
And also then in AutoCAD, you might want to make sure that you clear the recent list.
Oh, okay.
So that it forgets you had an A drive, and you opened that file from A.
Okay.
Give it a shot.
Now, one other quick question.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story with OpenWith? I've never been able to make heads or tails of that.
Basically, every file, well, here's the way it works. On the original Macintosh operating system,
mm-hmm.
every file had a creator bit attached to it, so that when you double-clicked on a file, the operating system looked to see what program created that file and then used that program to open the file. Windows, when they made their own operating system, didn't quite manage to copy that part. What they did instead was did it by extension. So .doc files belong to Word, .xls files belong to Excel.
Okay.
The problem is there are multiple programs out there that use .doc as an extension. Just
yeah.
to give you one.
And multiple programs that can open a .doc.
Right, and multiple programs that could, for example, open JPEGs or GIF files, that sort of fare. So what you end up with is the possibility that multiple files could open this, and you may not want the run you originally had. You find a new one and you'd rather use that.
Okay.
So if you select Open With, then you pick a program, say, always use this one. From now on, when you double-click on the file, it'll use the new program to open it rather than the old program.
And the trick to open with is you left-click on the file and then shift-right-click on the file, and you usually then get the open with command.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
Okie doke.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
See you later.
Our next caller is Tony from Greece. Welcome, Tony. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
I have a simple challenge for you, because I know you guys are very smart.
We're very simple. We need simple challenges.
Okay, my OS is Windows XP Pro, and before I upgraded to XP Pro, when I went to shutdown, I had an auto shutdown. Boom, shut right down. Now I'm getting a screen that says it's safe to shut off your computer, and I have to do it manually. A simple thing, and I'm hoping somewhere I can go in and change that to the auto shutdown.
Usually that, I've seen that in the BIOS. If you turn your power management off, then it doesn't know it can power down. You want to leave power management turned on, but set all of the settings to never.
Right. Okay.
So that it's still on, but it won't try to override your power management inside Windows itself.
Okay, so I go right in the BIOS. All right.
There you go.
Thank you. I knew it was simple.
It is simple.
Yeah,
and
thanks.
So are we. Thank you, Tony. Our next caller is Alan from Lima. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Didn't we just have you on?
No, that was the other guy that has a computer
in Lima. The other guy in Lima. That was Dave.
Who of them in Lima?
This is Alan from Lima. Man, you guys are just right up there. What's up?
Okay, about 3 months ago, I installed a 50-gig hard drive. I already had a 20 in my computer. I hooked it up as a slave on there, okay? And when it was my file system is FAT32, and it was registering that I could only have 5.9 of gigs of space on that 50-gig hard drive. So I went and pulled a maneuver, and I reformatted my computer, and now I've lost the 50.
This sounds more like a BIOS problem than anything else. How old is your machine?
It's about 2 years.
That
could be
30 gig limit. I mean that board.
It shouldn't give a 5 gig. There was an 8 gig limit and then a 30 gig limit and now 128 gig limit.
Right.
Also, some of the hard drives will be jumpered to physically limit the drive.
The number
for the
head,
older BIOS.
The head, the sectors.
Right.
And
I used to have two icons for both drives when you went into my computer. Mm-hmm. Now it just says local disk after I reformatted.
Right, that's the C drive.
Yeah, but I used to have two. Used to be able to access both. Now it registers as the second one. It says location zero.
You said you're running this as XP?
Yep.
All right. What you've got, XP is different than Windows 98. You've got to go into, if it's not showing up and you reformatted it,
mm-hmm.
you've got to go under the disk management. Let's see, where is it? Adding hard drives to XP are totally different than the old Windows way. You've got to go into disk, what is it, service management?
Disk administrator.
Disk administrator. Disk administrator, and underneath there you will see
where
the drive.
That at?
Start programs administrative programs. No, they moved it on XP again. It's in the control panel. Administrative tools.
And then you will see underneath that disk manager. There below that, once that opens up, you will see your A drive, your C drive. You will see this other drive as not being formatted or initialized or assigned a drive letter. You've got to right click on that and do all your work from there.
Oh, all right.
Okie doke.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks. Yep. We're going to take a quick break, back in just a couple of minutes with Sound Bites on 1180 WHAM. And that was certainly the longest-running musical intro. Our next caller is George from Victor. Welcome, George. What's your question?
Yeah, great show, guys.
Thank you
for your help. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Real quick one. I'm running Windows 2000. I have Word 2000 also on there. Every time I bring up Word 2000, on my toolbar, appears the letters EZP every time it adds another set of EZP letters, which appear to stand for Easy Photo. So after the 10th time I've opened Windows, I have 10 EZPs on my toolbar.
Do you have Easy Photo?
No.
Did you?
Yeah.
Do you have a scanner or camera?
I have a SanDisk loaded onto the thing.
Because sometimes the software that comes
with
scanners or cameras sets it up in your registry so that you can scan directly into Word, for example.
Ah.
So you might have to look through your add remove control panel and see if there's that EZP or Easy Photo or something like that that you can remove.
Okie doke.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sorry, we are done for another week. I apologize to everybody we didn't get to. I want to thank Dave Enright and Steve Ray for their able work in answering the questions today. Rob Linton, the reticent Rob Linton on the buttons, the Rob Bot on the buttons today. We'll see you next week. Please vote in the poll, soundbites.org. If you didn't get your questions answered today, give us a call next Friday at 7 o'clock on our news. But until next Saturday, it's Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.